All right, let's dive into something that might sound a bit dry at first, but trust me, it's got more twists and turns than you might think. We're talking Supreme Court, banks, and a case that echoes all the way to today's world of fintech.
Buckle up, it's Clark v. Securities Industry Association.
From 1987, no less. And the question at the heart of it seems pretty simple. Can banks operate discount brokerages?
Simple question? Maybe. But the answer?
Well, that's where things get interesting. And it all boils down to how the court interpreted a law that was already decades old when this case came along.
Talk about a blast from the past. So to set the scene for our listeners, can you give us a quick rundown of the National Bank Act of 1864 and how that ties into all of this?
Sure. The National Bank Act was all about establishing a national banking system in the U.S., you know, kind of bringing some order to the Wild West of banking back then.
Makes sense. But then we get the McFadden Act of 1927. Right. And the McFadden Act was essentially an amendment to the National Bank Act, but with some pretty important additions. It tried to prevent banks from having too much power by limiting their geographic reach.
So keeping things fair.
Exactly. And a big part of that was defining what a branch is. The act focused on those core banking functions, you know, the things we typically associate with a bank, taking deposits, making loans, paying checks.
Got it. So we've got the National Bank Act laying the groundwork, and then the McFadden Act coming in to refine things and, like you said, keep the playing field level.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's bring in the players in this legal drama. Who are we dealing with in Clark?
Okay, so on one side, we've got two national banks, Security Pacific National Bank and Union Planters National Bank. Both of them were looking to offer discount brokerage services.
Okay. And on the other side?
We have the Securities Industry Association, or SIA. They represented all the traditional brokers who were, shall we say, less than thrilled about this whole bank brokerage thing.
Yeah, I can imagine that might cause some tension. But why exactly were the brokers so concerned about banks dipping their toes into the brokerage business?
Well, banks already have this built-in advantage, right? They're where people keep their money. The SIA was worried that banks would use that existing customer relationship to just steamroll the brokerage market, kind of like using their home court advantage.
That makes sense. So the SIA decides to take them to court to fight this whole thing.
Yep.
But before we even get to the heart of the case, you know, whether or not these brokerages qualify as branches under the law, there's this preliminary hurdle they had to clear.
Uh-huh.
It's called standing. Can you break that down for us?
Standing is basically the court asking, does this party even have the right to bring this case before us?
So not just anyone can walk into court and challenge a law they don't like.
Exactly. They need to be directly affected by the law in question.
Okay, so how did the court figure out if the SIA had standing in this case?
Well, they used something called the zone of interest test, which came from a previous case, Data Processing v. Camp.
Zone of interest. Sounds intriguing.
It basically asks if the plaintiff's interests, in this case, the SIA's interests, are aligned with what the law was designed to protect.
Okay, so did the SIA pass the test?
They did. The court said, look, the SIA represents brokers, and part of the whole point of the McFadden Act was to prevent monopolies and ensure a level playing field in finance. If banks are allowed to just dominate the brokerage market, that directly hurts the SIA's members, and it throws off that balance we're trying to maintain.
Makes sense. So they cleared the first hurdle. SIA had standing to sue.
Yeah.
But I understand there was a dissenting opinion on this whole standing issue.
There was. Justice Harlan agreed that, yeah, the SIA had standing in this particular case, but he was worried about applying this zone of interest test too broadly.
Too broadly.
Yeah, he said there needs to be a really clear link between what the plaintiff wants and what the law was trying to do. Otherwise, you could have people challenging agency decisions all the time, even if they weren't really affected by them.
Hmm. So it's like, how far do we go with this idea of standing?
Exactly. And it's a debate that legal scholars still grapple with today. Because if it's too easy to challenge agency decisions, well, that can bog down the whole regulatory process.
Wow. So even this seemingly procedural thing, standing, can open up a whole can of worms.
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of what makes this case so fascinating. It's not just about banks and brokerages. It's about broader questions of legal interpretation about the power of regulatory agencies and who gets to challenge their decisions.
Right. It gets to the heart of how our system works.
Exactly.
All right. So the SIA is officially in the game. The court has said you have a valid argument. But now we get to the main event. What exactly is a branch in this new world of discount brokerages? That's where we'll pick up in the next part of our deep dive. Okay, so the stage is set. We've got this battle brewing between traditional brokers and banks wanting to expand their reach.
Mm.
But as we know, the whole thing hinges on that seemingly simple word, branch.
Right, because the McFadden Act, which we talked about earlier, really boils down to that definition. So the big question is, do these discount brokerages, where you're basically just executing trades, do those count as bank branches?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because if we go back to how the Act defines a branch, it's all about those core functions. Taking deposits, paying checks, lending money. And discount brokerages, they weren't doing any of that. They were just handling stock transactions.
Exactly.
So you almost wonder, why even bother with this whole case if it's that clear-cut?
Well, the SIA argued that even though these brokerages weren't operating like traditional bank branches, they still posed a threat to that competitive balance the McFadden Act was supposed to protect. But here's where it gets interesting. The controller of the currency, who's basically in charge of regulating national banks, had actually already given the banks the green light.
Oh, really? So the regulator was on the bank's side.
Yeah, they basically took a more flexible view of the law. They said, look, these brokerages aren't engaging in those classic banking activities, so they don't qualify as branches under the McFadden Act.
Okay, so we've got the brokers saying this is unfair competition, the banks saying, hey, we're just innovating, and the regulator siding with the banks. So what did the Supreme Court ultimately decide? Who won this tug of war?
Well, in the end, the court sided with the comptroller and the banks. They really emphasized the historical context of the McFadden Act. They pointed out that, you know, for years, banks had offered services that weren't those core functions, things like trust services, without anyone raising a big fuss.
So it was kind of like, hold on, banks have been doing this sort of thing forever, and it hasn't caused the sky to fall. What's the big deal about brokerages?
Exactly. Plus, the court made this interesting point about how the McFadden Act was, you know, kind of a compromise in the first place. It prevented banks from just becoming these all-powerful giants, but it also allowed them to stay competitive with state banks. So letting them offer these additional services helped maintain that balance.
Right, because you don't want to stifle innovation entirely.
Exactly.
But I'm guessing not everyone on the court was thrilled with this outcome. I mean, there had to be some dissenting voices, right?
Oh, absolutely. Justice Stevens, he actually agreed with the majority opinion, but he wrote his own separate opinion where he really emphasized how important it was that the SIA brought this challenge in the first place. He basically said, look, they were right to raise these concerns because it goes straight to the heart of what the McFadden Act was trying to do, preventing monopolies and ensuring fair competition.
So even though he ultimately agreed with the outcome, he was like, hey, this was a valid concern and it needed to be addressed.
Mm.
What about the other side? Was there a dissenting opinion that really pushed back against the majority?
There was. And their big worry was that this decision would basically open the floodgates and allow banks to expand their power without any real checks and balances. It's almost kind of eerie how their concerns actually echo a lot of the debates we're having today about fintech companies and all these non-traditional banking models that are popping up.
Oh, wow. So it's like they were foreshadowing the future of finance in a way.
It's really quite fascinating to see how those concerns from back then are still so relevant today. It shows you how a single legal decision can have these ripple effects that extend far beyond the specific case at hand.
Absolutely. And it makes you realize that Clark wasn't just about banks and brokerages. It was about these much broader questions of regulatory power and how we adapt our laws to keep up with an ever-changing financial landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So even within the court, you had these different perspectives on what this decision could mean for the future of banking.
And that's what makes studying these cases so interesting, right? It's not just about memorizing the facts and the outcome. It's about understanding those nuances, those different interpretations, and how they shape our understanding of the law.
Yeah, it's like peeling back the layers of an onion.
Exactly. There's always more to uncover.
And speaking of uncovering layers, I think the Clark decision offers some really valuable insights into a concept that we as lawyers grapple with all the time, statutory interpretation.
Oh, definitely.
Because laws, as we know, are often written in these broad strokes, and then it's up to the courts to figure out how to apply them to very specific real-world situations. And those situations, as we've seen with banking and technology, are constantly changing.
Right. And Clark is a perfect example of that. You have the McFadden Act, which was written way back in 1927, a time when banking was a completely different ballgame. And then, boom, in the 1980s, you have this rise of discount brokerages. So the court had to figure out how to apply this old law designed for those traditional brick-and-mortar banks to this brand-new, evolving financial landscape. landscape.
It's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole.
I know, right? But the Clark decision shows us that it's not always about finding a perfect fit. Sometimes it's about understanding the underlying purpose of the law and figuring out how to make it work in a new context.
So it's not just about blindly applying the letter of the law. It's about interpreting it in a way that's faithful to the original intent, but also adaptable to new challenges.
You nailed it. And that brings us to a really fascinating question, and one that I think will lead us nicely into the final part of our deep dive today. How might the logic of the Clark decision be applied to today's fintech world?
Ooh, yes. Because we are seeing a very similar story play out today, aren't we? We've got these fintech companies pushing the boundaries of traditional finance, just like banks were doing with those discount brokerages back in the 80s.
It's amazing, isn't it? Like, history is rhyming. Think about companies offering peer-to-peer lending, mobile payments, robo-advisors, you name it. Are these innovations fundamentally changing the game in a way that requires us to take a fresh look at our existing regulations, just like discount brokerages did back then?
That's a question worth pondering.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to dive into that very topic in the final part of our deep dive. It's wild to think that a 1987 Supreme Court case about banks and discount brokerages could be so relevant to what's happening in finance today.
Right. It's like Clark v. Securities Industry Association was giving us a sneak peek at the regulatory roller coaster we're on now with fintech.
Seriously, it's almost the same story playing out, just with a tech upgrade and some new players.
Exactly. Back then, it was brokers versus banks wanting to get in on the action. Now it's the same banks and the big players in finance trying to figure out how to handle these agile fintech companies popping up everywhere.
Yeah, and the big question is, how do we regulate all of this? I mean, so many of our financial rules were written before the internet even existed.
You're telling me. That's where the lessons from Clark are so important. Remember how the court had to grapple with the McFadden Act from 1927?
That one about brick and mortar banks.
Yep. And they had to decide if it even applied to those newfangled discount brokerages.
It's like trying to apply horse and buggy rules to the world of self-driving cars.
Perfect analogy. And just like with those self-driving cars, we can't just ignore the new reality. We have to adapt.
Okay, so how did the court even approach that challenge back in Clark? Did they just throw their hands up and say, the law's outdated, so whatever goes?
No, not at all. They really dug into the core ideas behind the McFadden Act and realized that the law's goal was to keep a few big banks from controlling everything. It was about fair competition.
So it wasn't about the specific words of the law so much as the bigger picture, right?
Yeah.
What were they trying to achieve with it?
Exactly. And that's the crucial lesson for regulating fintech. We have to ask ourselves, what are those fundamental things we're trying to protect in finance? Consumer safety, financial stability, making sure no one has a monopoly.
Like, those core principles are our North Star, guiding us through uncharted territory. We got to keep our eyes on that North Star, even when things change around us.
I like that. It's not about holding on to old rules just because they're old. It's about understanding the values behind them and making sure those values are still upheld as technology and the players change.
Okay, so we've got our North Star, but how do we apply that to the Wild West of fintech? I mean, we've got everything from lending platforms to robo-advisors to companies letting you buy pieces of Picassos with crypto. It's a lot.
Right. It's a whirlwind of new stuff, and that's what makes regulating it so tough. But Clark gives us a framework. Just because a fintech company doesn't fit neatly into the old rules doesn't mean they get a free pass. We need to ask, are these new players, even if they're doing things differently, are they creating the same kinds of risks that our existing regulations are designed to address?
So it's not about the tech itself, but the potential impact, right?
Yeah.
Are they making fraud more likely? Making the financial system shakier? Putting consumers at risk?
You got it. Look past the shiny new bells and whistles and focus on what they're actually doing and what could go wrong. If those potential problems match up with the risks our rules are trying to prevent, well, then we need to figure out how to adapt those rules or create new ones that fit this changing landscape.
That makes a lot of sense. Can't just jam a square peg into a round hole and hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
We need regulations that actually make sense in the new world of finance.
And the cool thing is, Clark shows us that it's totally possible. The court found a way to make an old law work for a new challenge, and we can do the same. It takes careful thinking, willingness to adapt, and really understanding the principles we're trying to protect.
Well said. It's amazing that Clark v. Securities Industry Association, a case about banks and brokerages from way back in 1987, turns out to be so useful for figuring out how to handle fintech today. Who knew?
Right. It just shows that the law is a living thing, always changing and adapting to meet new challenges. And the things we learn from past cases can help guide us as we navigate the future.
Totally agree. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Clark v. Securities Industry Association. Hope you found it enlightening.
Yeah, and who knows what new challenges await us in finance and tech. One thing's for sure, we'll need to rely on careful analysis, adaptation, and a commitment to those core values to guide us.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp and those eyes on the horizon.